Chapter 5. A Changing World. The Queen of the Elves sat in state on a diamond throne in her palace, surrounded by her courtiers, foundlings and lost boys, and creeping creatures with no names, all the detritus of the fairy folk. She had chosen to sparkle today. The everlasting sunlight shining through the exquisitely carved stone windows had been pitched exactly to strike the tiny gems on her wings so that delicate rainbows of light danced around the audience chamber as she moved. The courtiers, lounging about the place in lace-trimmed velvet and feathers, were almost, but not quite, as beautifully dressed. Her eyes slid sideways, ever alert to the actions of her lords and ladies. Was that Lord Lankin over there in the corner with Lord Mustard Seed? Whispering? And where was Lord Peasblossom? One day, she thought, she would have his head on a pole. She didn't trust him at all, and his glamour had been strong of late, almost as glorious as her own. Or, she reminded herself bitterly, as glorious as her own had been before. Before that young witch, Tiffany Aching, had come into Fairyland and humiliated her. Lately, she had felt shivers between their two worlds, understood that things were shifting, the edges becoming more blurred, softer. A few of the stronger elves had even been slipping through from time to time for a little mischief. Perhaps soon she could lead the elves on a proper raiding party, fetch another child to play with, have her revenge on the Aching witch. The queen smiled at the thought, licking her lips in anticipation of the fun ahead. But for now there was other troubling news to deal with. Goblins. Mere worms who should be grateful if an elvish lord or lady even looked their way, but who were now foolishly refusing to do her bidding. She would show them all, she thought. Lords Lankin, Mustard Seed, Peasblossom. They would all see how powerful she was again. They would see her strike down this goblin filth. But where was Peasblossom? The goblin prisoner was brought into the audience chamber under guard. The whole effect was visually stunning, the goblin thought sourly. Exactly as a fairy court would look in a human child's storybook, until you looked at the faces and realised that there was something not quite right about the eyes and the expressions of the beautiful creatures in the scene. The queen considered the goblin for a while, resting her fine-boned chin on the fingers of one exquisitely thin hand, her alabaster brow furrowed. "You goblin! Call yourself of the dew the sunlight, I believe. You and your kind have long enjoyed the protection of this court. Yet I hear talk of rebellion, a refusal to do my bidding. Before I hand you over to my guards for their amusement, tell me why this is." Her melodious voice was rich with charm as the words were spoken, but the goblin seemed unmoved. He should have fallen to his knees and begged for her forgiveness, hypnotized by the power of the queen's glamour. But instead, he stood his ground stockily and grinned at her. Grinned at the queen. "Well, queenie, it's like this, you see. Goblins is now treated as upright citizens in human world. Humans say goblins useful. We likes being useful. We gets paid for being useful and finding out things and making things." The queen's beautiful visage slipped. She glared at the cheeky creature in front of her. "That's impossible," she shouted. "You goblins are the dregs. Everyone knows that." "Ha-ha," laughed the goblin. "Queenie not so clever as she thinks. Goblins riding on hog's back now. Goblins know how to drive the iron horses." There was a shiver in the court as the goblin uttered the word iron, and the magical glimmer dimmed. The queen's dress changed colour from silver gossamer to blood-red velvet, and her blonde ringlets turned into straight, raven-black locks. Her courtiers followed suit as the pastel silks and lace made way for leather breeches, scarlet sashes and scraps of fur over woad-covered torsos. Elven stone knives were drawn and sharp teeth bared. The little goblin did not flinch.
"I don't believe you," said the queen. "After all, you are just a goblin."
"Just a goblin, yes, your queeniness," he said quietly. "A goblin what understands iron and steel. Steel as goes round and round and chuffs. Takes people to faraway places. And a goblin what is a citizen of Ankh-Morpork. And you know what that means, my lady. The Dark One there gets upset when his citizens get killed."
"You are lying," said the queen.
The Lord Veterinari would not care what happens to you. You goblins always lie, of the dew the sunlight. Not my name any more. I am now of the lathe the swarf, said the goblin proudly.
Swarf, said the queen, what is that?
Itty bits of iron these, queenie, said the goblin, his eyes hardening. Of the lathe the swarf, no liar. You talks to me like that again, your magisteriousness. I opens my pockets. Then we sees what swarf is.
The queen drew back, her eyes fixed on the goblin's hands hovering near the pockets of his dark blue jacket, wooden toggles fastening it over his skinny chest.
You dare threaten me, she said. Here, in my own realm, you worm, when I could shrivel your heart within you with just a word, or have you dropped where you stand?
She gestured to the guards standing ready with their crossbows aimed at the goblin.
I is no worm for you, Queenie. I have the swarf, tiny bits of steel that can float in the air. But I is here to bring news, a warning. Of the lathe the swarf still has fancy for the old days. I likes to see humans squirm, likes to see you fairy folk stirring things up, I does. Some goblins thinks as I does, but not so many now. Some goblins almost not goblins now, almost human. I don't likes it, but they says the times these are changing. The money is good, you see, Queenie.
Money? Sneered the queen. I give you goblins money, you...
She paused as she saw the goblin's hand move into his pocket. Could the horrible little creature really be bringing iron into her world? Iron, a terrible substance for any of the fairy folk. Painful, destructive. It blinded, deafened, made an elf feel more alone than any human could ever feel. She finished her sentence with gritted teeth.
Worthy creature!
Gold as melts away as sun rises, said the goblin. They, we, gets real money now. I just wants goblins to remain goblins, goblins with status, respect, not pushed around no more by you or anyone else.
He glared at Peas Blossom, who had suddenly stepped to the side of the queen.
I don't believe you, said the queen.
Your funeral, Queenie, said the goblin. Don't believe me. Go to gate. Not so much trouble now, old witch gone. You sees for yourself. World has changed, Queenie.
And the queen thought, changed, yes. She had felt the tremors, known something momentous was afoot, but not known exactly what. So the old witch was gone. With no hag to stop them, why, she realised, we can ride through in splendour once more. Then her face fell. Except for this swarf, this iron.
Bind this maggot's arms behind him, she ordered her guards, pointing at the goblin. I wish to see if he speaks true. And he will ride with us, she smiled. If he speaks false, we will tear out his tongue.
Next morning, alone in Granny Weatherwax's cottage, her cottage now, Tiffany woke early, knowing that her world had changed. Hugh was watching her like a hawk. She sighed. It was going to be a busy day. She had been in many houses where death had recently visited, and always the lady of the house, if there was one, would be shining anything that shined and cleaning everything that could be cleaned. And so, with rags and polishing cloths, Tiffany Aching cleaned everything that was already spick and span clean. It was a kind of unspoken mantra. The world had gone bad, but at least the grate had been polished and now had a fire ready to light in it. All the time, like a statue, there was you staring at her. Did cats know about death, she wondered? What about the cats of witches? Especially, what about Granny Weatherwax's cat? Tiffany tided that thought away for now and started on the kitchen, burnishing anything that could be burnished, and yes, it shone. She was cleaning things already clean, but the algebra of mourning required the effort of getting all the death out of the house, and there was no shrinking from it. You cleaned everything regardless. She'd finished in the kitchen and the scullery, leaving everything so bright that her eyes watered, and then there was nothing for it but to go upstairs. On her hands and knees, with bucket and brush and rags and grease, that is, elbow grease, Tiffany cleaned and cleaned until her knuckles were red and she was satisfied. But that wasn't the end of it. There was Granny's small wardrobe, with its few well-worn and serviceable dresses hanging in there, along with a cloak. All black, of course. Tucked away on a shelf was the zephyr billow cloak Tiffany herself had given Granny, unworn as far as she could see, but kept carefully like a special possession. She felt her eyes begin to prickle. Beside the bed were Granny Weatherwax's boots. Good, serviceable boots, Tiffany thought, and Granny had hated waste. But to actually wear them... She was going to find it hard enough to follow in Granny's footsteps. She swallowed. She was sure she could find a good home for the boots. In the meantime, well, she poked forward a toe and pushed them out of sight beneath the bed. Then, of course, there was the kitchen garden and, above all, the herbs. Tiffany found a pair of heavy gloves in the scullery. You didn't go into Granny's herbs without heavy gloves until they knew you. Granny had foraged, bartered, and been given herbs from just about everywhere, and she had rotating spinach and doubting plums, ginny-come-nether, twirlabout, tickle-my-fancy-root, jump-in-the-basin, and jack-go-to-bed-and-never-get-up, daisy-upsy-daisy, and old-man-root. There was a clump of love-lies oozing by the jack-by-moonlight, and a very active maiden's respite. Tiffany did not know what all of them were for. She would have to ask Nanny Og, or Magrat Garlic, who, like her husband Verence, the King of Lanka, was very enthusiastic about herbs. Basically, if it had something herbal in it, Magrat and Verence thought it would do you good. With some of the herbs in Granny's garden, this might be doubtful, at least in the short term, and it might not be wise to stray too far from the privy. Though, unlike her husband, Magrat did actually know her troubling Tony from her multitude route. It was never easy being a witch. Oh, the broomstick was great, but to be a witch you needed to be sensible, so sensible that sometimes it hurt. You dealt with the reality, not what people wanted. The reality right now was suddenly you, meowing and banging her head against Tiffany's legs, demanding food, which she then ignored completely when Tiffany went back into the kitchen and placed a dish of it down for her on the floor. Tiffany went outdoors again and fed the chickens, let the goats out to graze, had a word with the bees, and then thought, I've done my bit. The place is spotless, the bees are happy, even the lean-to is clean. If Nanny can come in and feed the animals, keep an eye on you, then I can go back home for a few days. Reaching the chalk after a flight that was long and, sadly, very wet, since the rain was teeming down, and, contrary to popular belief, no witch Tiffany knew had yet managed to control a broomstick whilst also using an umbrella, she flew to the house of young Millie Robinson, the Feagles clinging on behind, under, and actually on her in their usual style. Millie's two baby boys looked well fed, but the little girl, baby Tiffany, didn't. Unfortunately, witch Tiffany was used to this sort of thing, especially when the mothers weren't very clever or had bossy mothers and thought feeding the boys was the main thing in life. It was why, just after the baby's birth, she had whispered that spell into the baby's ear. A simple tracking magic, so she would know if any harm befell the little girl. Just a precaution, she had told herself at the time. There was no use getting nasty about all this, so she took the young woman aside and said, Millie, listen. Yes, your boys have to be straight and strong when they grow up, but my mother always used to say to me, your son's your son until he takes a wife, but your daughter is your daughter all of your life. And I think that's right enough. You help your mother out still, don't you? And she helps you. So fair shares for the little girl is the right thing to do. Please. Then, because the carrot, or in this case the breast milk, sometimes needed to be accompanied by the stick, she added sternly, the pointy hat making her seem older and wiser than she would otherwise appear, I shall be watching after her interests. A little bit of menace often did the trick, she had learned, and of course she would watch. Then there was only one person she wanted to talk to, and the rain was getting harder still as her stick drifted down towards the Feagle Mound on the hill, Rob and the other Feagles toppling off as she approached. Daft Woolly made a spectacularly bad landing, head first into the gorse, and a rabble of young Feagles rushed up joyously to unscrew him. There were a couple of Rob's older sons lounging around outside the entrance. They were scrawny, even by Feagle standards, with barely a wisp of beard hair between them and impractically low-slung spogs knocking about their knees. Their kilts hung low on their skinny hips. To Tiffany's amazement, she could see the top bands of coloured pants riding high above them. Pants? On a Feagle? The times were indeed changing. "Pull yon kilts up, lads," Rob muttered as they pushed their way past. The Kelder was in her chamber, surrounded by Feagle babies, all rolling around on a floor covered with the fleeces of sheep gone to another land. And the first words she said were,
I know, she sighed and added, it's grieving I am, but the wheel takes all in time. Her face crinkled into a huge smile. It's happy I am to see you as leader of the witches, Tiffan.
Well, thank you, said Tiffany. How did Jeanie know, she wondered for a moment, but every Kelder used the way of the Hidlins to see things past, present, and future. And it was a secret known only to the Kelders, passed down one to the other. She understood, too, that although Jeanie was very small, she was someone to whom she could tell every secret, and the assurance that it would never be passed on to anyone. And now she hesitantly said, Jeanie, I don't think I could ever fill her boots.
Really, said the Kelder sharply. Didn't you think Esmeralda Weatherwax may nae have kenned the same thing when the position was gien to her? Do you suppose yon hag then said, nay me, I'm nae good enough?
The wise little Pixie was looking at Tiffany as if she was some kind of specimen, a new plant, perhaps. And then she lowered her voice and said, I ken well enough that ye will be a good leader. Though only the first amongst equals, rather than a leader, Tiffany added. At least, I'm sure that's what the other witches think. Her voice trailed off, her doubts hanging in the air.
Is that so? Said the Kelder.
She went quiet for a moment, then said softly, Ye who kissed the spirit of winter and sent him packing, aye.
Yet I ken that ye have in front of ye something less easy, Tiffan. There is a change coming in the heavens, and ye will need to be there.
Her voice grew even more sombre, and her small eyes were fixed on Tiffany now.
Be aware, Tifahin, this is a time of transition, she said. Mistress Weatherwax is nae longer wi' us, and her going leaves a hole that others will nae fail to see. We must watch the gateways, and ye must take great care, for them ye don't wish to know might be seeking ye out.
It was good to be home, Tiffany thought, when at last she arrived there, back at her parents' farm. It was even called Home Farm. Back where her mother cooked a hot dinner every night. Back where she could sit at the big wooden kitchen table, which was scarred by generations of achings, and become a little girl again. But she wasn't a little girl any more. She was a witch. One with two steadings to look after. And over the next week, as she flew back and forth from the chalk to Lanker, from Lanker to the chalk, in weather that seemed to be enjoying a competition to be the wettest ever for the time of year, it seemed to her that she was always arriving late, wet, and tired. People were nearly always polite, to her face anyway, and certainly to the pointy hat. But she could tell from what they didn't say that somehow, indefinably, whatever she did, it wasn't quite enough. She got up earlier every day and went to bed later, but it still wasn't enough. She needed to be a good witch, a strong witch. And in between the carrying and the healing, the helping and the listening, she could feel sudden prickles of alarm run up and down her body. Jeanie had warned her that something dreadful might be coming. Would she be up to the job? She didn't even think she was doing very well with all the usual stuff. She couldn't be Granny Weatherwax for them in Lanker, and it was getting harder and harder to be Tiffany Aching for the chalk. Even at home, even there. She struggled in wearily one night, longing for food, peace and her bed, and as her mother pulled a huge pot from the big black oven and placed it in the centre of the table, a family row was just starting.
"I met Sid Pigeon outside the Baron's Arms today," her brother Wentworth, a strapping lad of not quite old enough for the pub yet, but certainly old enough to hang around outside, was saying.
"Sid Pigeon?" Mrs. Aching wondered.
"The younger of the two Pigeon brothers," her father said.
Younger, thought Tiffany. That counted for a lot in farming country. It meant the older brother got the farm, though if she remembered correctly, the Pigeon farm was a pretty poor place, not very well run. Wasn't Mr. Pigeon a regular at the Baron's Arms? She tried to remember Mrs. Pigeon and failed. But yes, she remembered Sid. She'd seen him only a few weeks back up near Two Shirts, a small boy who had seemingly grown into his name when someone had given him a peaked cap and a whistle to hang around his neck.
"You were telling me about them railway jobs," Wentworth went on enthusiastically. "He's earning good money, is Sid. Says they need more men. It's the future, Dad. Railways, not sheep."
"Don't get any daft ideas, lad," his father warned. "Railways is for them as don't take on land to farm. Not like us Achings, not like you. You know what your future holds for you. It's right here, where it's always been for an Aching lad."
"But,"
Wentworth wasn't happy. Tiffany shot him a look. She knew how he felt. And after all, she herself wasn't doing what had been expected of her, was she? If she had, she'd be getting married about now, like her sisters had, getting ready to produce a few more grandchildren for her mother to fuss over. Her mother seemed to be thinking of the same thing. "You always seem to be somewhere else these days," she said, changing the subject from Wentworth to Tiffany, trying hard not to sound like she was complaining. "I wish you could be with us more, Tiff," she added, a bit sadly.
"Don't bother the lass. She's some kind of top-notch witch now, you know. She can't be everywhere," her father said.
Feeling like a little girl, Tiffany said, "I try to be around here as much as possible, but we don't really have enough witches to do the work that's needed." Her mother smiled nervously and said, "I know you work hard, dear. There's lots of people who stop me in the road to say my girl has helped their kid or their father. Everybody sees that you're running about like nobody's business. And you know what people are saying? They are saying to me, you are growing up like your granny. After all, she used to tell the Baron what to do, and you do the same." "Well, Granny Aching wasn't a witch," said Tiffany.
"That depends," said her father, turning away from Wentworth, who stomped out and slammed the kitchen door behind him.
Joe Aching looked after him for a moment, then sighed and winked at Tiffany.
"There are surely different kinds of witches. You remember how your granny wanted the shepherd's hut burned down once she was dead? Burn everything, she told me."
He smiled and said, "I almost did what I was told. But there was a thing she had, and it was not for the burning. So I wrapped it up, and now, seeing you, my girl, here's a little memento from Granny Aching."
To Tiffany's surprise, her father was crying under his smiles as he gave her a little package wrapped up in crinkled paper and tied with a piece of old wool. She opened it and turned the little ridged object over in her hand. "It's a shepherd's crown," she said. "I've seen them before. They're quite easy to find."
Joe Aching laughed, said, "Not this one. Your granny said it was special, the crown of crowns. And if the Shepherd of Shepherds picked it up, it would turn into gold. Look, beneath the grey you can see the hints of gold."
Tiffany looked at the little object while she ate her stew, made as only her mother could make it, and she thought about the days when Granny Aching would come down to the farm for a meal. It seemed to some that the old woman had lived on jolly sailor tobacco, and there was no doubt about it. When it came to sheep, Granny Aching knew everything. But the mind starts running all by itself, and Tiffany thought about all the things Granny had done and the things that Granny had said. Then the memories came as a cavalcade, whether she wanted them or not, settling on her like snow. Tiffany thought of the time she had walked with her Granny. Mostly in silence, sometimes with thunder and lightning, Granny Aching's sheepdogs at their heels. She had learned a lot from the old woman. "She taught me so much," she said to herself. "She built me as we were walking around after the sheep, and she told me all those things that I needed to know, and the first thing was to look after people." Of course, the other thing had been to look after the sheep. And all she had ever asked for was her shepherd's hut and some horrible tobacco. Tiffany dropped her spoon. It was all right to sob in this familiar kitchen, like she had when she was a girl. Immediately her father was there beside her.
"You can do a lot, Jigget, but no one could do it all."
"Yes," said her mother, "and we keep your bed ready every day, and we know you are doing a lot of good, and I am proud when I see you flying around. But you can't do everything for everybody. Don't go out again tonight, please."
"We like seeing our girl, but it'd be nice to see her properly and not always in a blur," her father added, putting his arm around her.
They finished their dinner in silence, a warm silence, and as Tiffany prepared to go up the stairs to her childhood bedroom, Mrs. Aching stood and pulled out an envelope from where she had tucked it out of the way on the dresser, amongst the blue and white jars that, surprisingly, in a working farm kitchen, were simply for show.
"There's a letter here for you, from Preston, I expect."
Her tone was very motherish now. She only had to say Preston, and there was a question there. And Tiffany crept up the stairs, feeling the care and love of her parents flowing around her and into her room, relishing the familiar creak of the boards. She placed the shepherd's crown on the shelf by her few books, a new treasure, and pulled on her nightdress wearily. Tonight, she decided, she would try to forget her fears, allow herself to just be Tiffany Aching for a while, not Tiffany Aching, the Witch of the Chalk. Then, while there was still light to see, she read Preston's letter. and the weariness fled for a moment, replaced by a wave of sheer happiness. Preston's letter was wonderful. Filled with new language, new words. Today he wrote about taking up a scalpel. Such a sharp, strong word. And how he had learned a new way to suture. Suture, Tiffany said quietly to herself. A soft word. So much smoother than scalpel. Almost healing. And in a way, she needed healing. Healing from the loss of Granny Weatherwax. Healing from the strain of too much to do. And healing from the effort of trying to match the expectations of the other witches. She carefully read every word, twice, then folded the letter up and put it away in a small wooden box in which she kept all his letters, as well as the beautiful golden hair pendant he had once given her. There was no point resealing it. She could keep nothing secret from the Feagles, and she preferred not to have the box full of the snail slime they used to re-stick anything they had opened. Then she slept in her childhood bedroom. Beside her there was the cat, Hugh. And Tiffany was a child again, a child with parents who loved her very much. But also a young girl, a girl with a boy who sends her letters. And a witch. A witch with a cat that was very special. While her parents lay in bed, talking about their daughter. "It's right proud of our girl I am," Joe Aching began. "And of course she is a really good midwife," Mrs. Aching said, adding rather sadly, "but I wonder if she might ever have children of her own. She doesn't talk about Preston to me, you know, and I don't much like to ask. Not like with her sisters," she sighed, "but so much is changing. Even Wentworth tonight."
"Oh, don't worry about him," Mr. Aching said. "'Tis right for a lad to want to find his own feet, and most likely he'll bluster for a bit and shout and argue, but he'll be here when we've gone, looking after the Aching land, you mark my words. There is nothing to beat land," he sniffed. "Certainly not them railways."
"But Tiffany's different," his wife continued. "What she's going to do I really don't know, though I do hope in time that she and Preston might settle round here. If he's a doctor and she's a witch, that's no reason why they can't be together, is it? Tiffany could have children too, then, like Hannah and Fastidia." They thought of their other daughters, of their grandchildren. Joe sighed. "She's not like our other daughters, love. I believe Tiffany may even surpass her grandmother," he said. And then he blew out the candles. And they slept, thinking of their Tiffany, a skylark among the sparrows. Chapter 6. Around the Houses. Walking steadily along the road to Lanker, with Mephistopheles trotting beside him, and his little cart rattling behind, and swallows swooping overhead, Geoffrey realised that his old home seemed a long way away now. It had only been a week or so, but as they climbed higher into the ramtops, he began to understand what geography meant in reality, rather than in the books Mr. Wiggle had let him read. Lanker and its surrounding villages had a lot of geography. At the end of a day's long but satisfying walk for both boy and goat, they arrived outside a village pub, which proclaimed its name as The Star, the sign promising excellent ales and food. "Well, let's see how excellent it is," Geoffrey thought. He unhitched the cart and went into the pub with the goat following close behind. The pub was full of working men, who were now not working but enjoying a pint or two before dinner. It was rather stuffy inside, with the usual rural tint of agricultural armpit. The regulars were used to people bringing a working dog in with them, but they were amazed to see a dusty but well-dressed lad bringing a goat into their pub. The rather skinny barman said, "We only allow dogs in here, mister." All eyes in the pub were by now focused on Mephistopheles, and Geoffrey said, "My goat is cleaner and more knowledgeable than any dog. He can count to 20. And when the time comes, he'll go outside to do his business. In fact, sir, if I can show him your privy now, he will use it when he needs it." One worker appeared to take umbrage at this point.
"Do you think that just because we work on the land we don't know nothing? I have a pint here that says that the goat can't do it."
Innocently, Geoffrey said, "You have a knowledgeable pint there, sir," and everyone in the pub laughed. Now every eye was on Geoffrey as he said, "Mephistopheles, how many people are in this pub?" The goat looked down his nose, and it was a nose a dowager would have been proud of, at the men around the bar and started his count, delicately hitting the floor with his hoof.
the noise suddenly being the only sound in the place. He hit the floor 8 times.
"He got it right," declared the barman.
"I saw something like that afore," said one of the men. "There were a travelling show, you know, clowns and tightrope walkers and folk with no arms and travelling doctors."
There was the usual man who puts weasels down his trousers in action too, hence the need for a doctor.
"They called it a carnival, and they had a horse they said could count, but it was just a trick."
Geoffrey smiled and said, "If a couple of you gentlemen would care to step out for a moment, I will ask my goat to do it again, and you will see that there is no trick involved." Intrigued now, several of the men stepped out, while the others started to take bets amongst themselves. "Gentlemen, my goat will tell you how many people are still in the room," said Geoffrey. Once again, daintily, Mephistopheles tapped out the correct number. Hearing the cheers, the men who had gone out came back in again, looking curious, and Mephistopheles's hoof registered each one as he entered. The barman laughed.
"This trick deserves a meal for you and your remarkable goat, mister. What does he like?"
"It's no trick, I assure you, but thank you. Mephistopheles will eat almost anything. He's a goat. Some scraps would be most acceptable. And for myself, just some bread would be welcome." A bowl of kitchen scraps was produced for Mephistopheles, and Geoffrey sat down beside him with his pint and a slab of bread and butter, chatting to some of the men who were interested in the goat. An interest which only deepened when Mephistopheles went out in the direction of the privy and after a while came back again.
"You actually managed to get him to do that?" said one of them in wonder.
"Yes," said Geoffrey. "I trained him from when he was very small. He's quite docile, really. Well, if I'm around."
"What do you mean?"
"It means he does what he's told, but he has a mind of his own as well. I wouldn't lose him for anything." Just then there were raised voices at the other end of the bar as one drinker, filled with the bluster that ale can give to a man, started a fight with someone else who had just come in. The more sensible people moved away as the two began to trade blows, seemingly intent on beating one another to death, while the barman bellowed about the damage to his furniture and threatened to wallop them with his grandfather's knobkerry, a souvenir from the Clatchian campaign, if they didn't stop. Mephistopheles was suddenly alert at Geoffrey's side, and every drinker who was sober understood in his soul that this was no time to be unpleasant to the lad. They didn't know how they knew, but there was a kind of visceral power there waiting to be unleashed.
"Why are they fighting? What's wrong?" Geoffrey asked his neighbour.
"An old grudge about a young lady," said the man, rolling his eyes. "A bad business. Someone's going to get hurt, you mark my words."
To everyone's astonishment, Geoffrey strolled across the pub, his goat watching his every step, dodged the wildly swinging blows and stood between the two men, saying, "There's no need to fight, you know." The barman's face fell. He knew what happened to people who tried to get between two idiots smelling blood, and then he could hardly believe his eyes, for the two men abruptly stopped fighting and were standing there looking rather bemused.
"Why don't you two just meet the young lady and see what she thinks before you start beating each other to death?" Geoffrey said softly.
The men looked at one another, and the bigger of the two said,
"He's right, you know."
And the pub audience laughed as the two men looked around at the wreckage, seemingly amazed that this could have had anything to do with them.
"There, that was easy, wasn't it?" said Geoffrey, returning to the bar.
"Ah," said the landlord, astonished that he wasn't having to pick a battered Geoffrey off the floor. "You're not a wizard, are you?"
"No," said Geoffrey, "it's a knack. It happens to me all the time when I need it," he smiled. "Mostly with animals and sometimes with people. But alas," he thought to himself, "not with my father. Never with him."
"Well, you must be some kind of wizard," said the barman. "You've broken up a fight between two of the nastiest bruisers we have around here."
He glared at the two miscreants.
"As for you two," he said, "don't come back here until you are sober. Look at the mess you've made."
He grabbed both of them and pushed them out of the door. The rest of the drinkers got back to their pints. The barman turned back to Geoffrey and looked at him in shrewd appraisal.
"You want a job, lad? No pay, but you get your keep."
"I can't take a job, but I'd be happy to stay for a few days," said Geoffrey with alacrity. "If you can find some vegetables for me, I eat no meat. And can there be a place for Mephistopheles as well? He's not very smelly."
"Probably no worse than the people we have in here," said the barman, laughing. "I tell you what, you and your goat can stay in the barn, and I'll give you your dinner and breakfast, and then after that we'll see."
The man held out a rather dirty hand.
"A deal, then?"
"Oh, yes, thank you. My name is Geoffrey."
The man hesitated.
"My name's Darling."
"Darling Dove." He looked at Geoffrey mournfully and said, "Have a laugh about it, will you? Everyone does. Might as well get it out of the way."
"Why?" said Geoffrey.
"Darling is a kind word, and so is Dove. How can these be anything to worry about?"
That night, Mr. Dove told his wife,
"I got us a new barboy. Funny Covey is too, but he seems, well, harmless. Sort of easy to talk to."
"Can we afford it, darling?" his wife said.
"Oh," said Darling Dove, "he just wants feeding. Doesn't even want meat, and somewhere to sleep. And he's got a goat. Quite a smart one, really. Does tricks and all. Might bring some more customers in."
"Well, dear, if you think it's a good idea."
"What are his clothes like?" asked Mrs. Dove.
"Pretty good," said Mr. Dove.
"And he talks like a toff. I wonder if he is running away from something. Best not to ask any questions, I reckon. I'll tell you what, though, between him and his goat, we won't have any trouble in the bar." And indeed, Geoffrey stayed at the Star for 2 days, simply because Mr. Dove liked him hanging around the place. And Mrs. Dove said she was sad when he told her husband that he had to move on.
"A strange boy, young Geoffrey. He kind of gives me the idea that everything is all right, even if I don't know what it is that is right. A sort of rightness, floating in the air. I'm really sorry that he's going," she said.
"Yes, dear," said Mr. Dove. "I asked him to stay, I really did, but he said he must go to Lanka."
"That's where they have the witches," said his wife. She made a face.
"Well," Mr. Dove said, "that's where he wants to go." He paused and added, "He said the wind is blowing him there."
Battling into a bitter headwind on her long journey back to her parents' farm, Tiffany felt that there was altogether too much wind in and around Lanka. Still, at least it wasn't raining, she told herself. Yesterday's rain had been awful, the kind of joyous rain where every cloud had decided to join the party once one cloud had cracked open the first deluge. She had felt proud of having the two steadings at first, flying between Lanka and the chalk every few days, but broomsticks are not very fast, or warm. It gets awfully cold up there, and no sensible witch ever took to the skies without several layers of flannelette between her and the stick. It was good that she could go back home to where her mother did the cooking, but even back home there was no time to rest, and being away in Lanka for half the week meant she was facing a plethora of demands from the chalk. People weren't getting nasty about it. After all, she was a witch, and Lanka had more people than the chalk, but there were these little strains beginning to develop. A few mutters, and she had a horrible feeling that some of the muttering was coming from other witches. Witches who were finding queues at their doors, people who had gone to find Granny Weatherwax and just found an empty cottage. Some of the problem in both steadings was with the old men left behind when their wives had died. A lot of them didn't know how to cook. Occasionally, some of the old ladies would help, and you would see them carrying a pot of stew round for the old man next door. But the witch part of Tiffany couldn't help but notice that this happened more often if the old lady was a widow and the old man had a nice cottage and a bit of money put by. There was always something that had to be done, and some days it seemed mostly to be about toenails. There was one old man in Lanka, a decent old boy, whose toenails were as sharp as a lethal weapon, and Tiffany had to ask Jason Ogg, a blacksmith, to make her a pair of secateurs tough enough to break through them. She always closed her eyes until she heard the patter of his toenails banging off the ceiling. But the old man called her his lovely lady and tried to give her money, and at least she now knew that the Feagles had a use for the toenail clippings. Witches liked useful things, Tiffany mused, as she tried to take her mind off the chill wind whipping around her. A witch would never have to ask for anything. Oh, no, no one wanted to owe a witch anything, and a witch didn't take money either. Instead, she accepted things she could make use of, food, and old clothing, and bits of cloth for bandages, and spare boots. Boots. She had tripped over Granny Weatherwax's boots again that very day. She had put them in the corner of the room now, and there they sat, almost staring at her when she was too weary to think. "You're not good enough yet to fill these boots," they seemed to say. "You'll have to do a lot more first." Of course, there always was such a lot to do. So many people never seemed to think about the consequences of their everyday actions. And then a witch on her broom would have to set out from her bed in the rain at the dead of night because of "I only" and its little friends "I didn't know" and "it's not my fault." "I only wanted to see if the copper was hot. I didn't know a boiling pot was dangerous. It's not my fault no one told me dogs that bark might also bite." and her favourite, I didn't know it would go off bang, when it said, goes bang, on the box it came in. That had been when little Ted Cooper had put an explosive banger, another tiny clue, into the carcass of a chicken after his mum's birthday party and nearly killed everybody around the table. Yes, she had bandaged and treated everybody, even the Joker, but she hoped very much his dad had kicked his ass afterwards. And when the witch wasn't there, well, what harm was there in trying out a few things for yourself? Most people knew about using plants to cure things. They were certain about that. But the thing about plants is that many of them look like all the others. And so Mistress Holland, wife of the Miller of the Chalk, had treated her husband's unfortunate skin condition with Lovelies oozing rather than with Medi-Day root, and now his skin had turned purple. Tiffany had treated the man, but then it had been time for her to go back to Lanka, and she was up and away again on her stick, hoping that they had both learned their lesson. She was very thankful that Nanny Ogg was not too far away from Granny's, no, her, cottage. There were a lot of things that Tiffany was good at, but cookery wasn't one of them, and so, just as she relied on her mum and dad for meals in the Chalk, in Lanka she relied on Nanny. Strictly speaking, this meant she was relying on Nanny's army of daughters-in-law, who couldn't do enough for their old Nanny. Enough wasn't really a long enough word to describe the numerous little tasks any young woman marrying into the Ogg family found were expected of her. But wherever the pair of them took their meals, either in Tiffany's little cottage in the woods, or at Tia Nanny Ogg, the overcrowded but very comfortable home where Nanny Ogg ruled the roost, it seemed that you was there too. No cat could move as fast as her, but you never saw her move fast, she just arrived. It was baffling. What was also baffling was how Grebo, Nanny's ancient tomcat, who treated a bit of eyeball scratching as a friendly hello, slunk away when you appeared. The white cat had clearly made her decision and was a constant presence in Tiffany's life in Lanka. Now, when Tiffany got ready for an afternoon of going round the houses, you would jump on the broomstick before Tiffany had even looked at it, which made Nanny laugh, saying, "She's got you down pat, my girl. Maybe she could go round the houses by herself." Nanny Ogg was actually rather impressed by Tiffany, but also worried. "Really," she said to her one day as they shared a quick meal, "you know you're good, Tiff. I know you're good. Granny, wherever she is now, knew you was good. But you don't have to keep trying to do it all on your own, my girl. Let some of them young girls around here, the apprentices, take some of the strain." She paused as she chewed on a big mouthful of stew, then added, "That young lumberjack up in the mountains what Esme sewed up just the day before she died? Well, young Harriet of Bilk's been going on up there to see to him, and doing a good job too." "Tiff, you have to do it your own way, I know, but you ain't the only witch in Lanka. Sometimes you needs to put your feet up and let the parade go by." Tiffany had barely had time to listen before she was back on her stick and heading down to the Chalk again. No rest for the busy witch with two steadings. But as the ear-numbing wind whistled by, she considered what Nanny had said. It was true that there were other witches in Lanka. But in the Chalk, unless Letitia decided to stop being just a baroness, Tiffany was the only witch. And if her forebodings were right, if Jeannie's words came true, then one witch for the Chalk might not be anywhere near enough. She shivered. She was looking forward to getting out of the icy wind and into the warmth of her mother's kitchen. But there was one person she needed to see first. It took Tiffany a long time to find Miss Tick, but eventually she landed in a little wood just outside Hamon Rye, where the travelling witch, the witchfinder, had stopped her caravan for tea. A small mule was tethered nearby, enjoying the contents of its feed bag. It looked at Tiffany as she approached and neighed. "He's called Joseph," said Miss Tick, "a real witch's mule." It had started to rain again, and Miss Tick quickly waved Tiffany up the wooden caravan steps. Tiffany was glad to see that there was a kettle bubbling on a little stove. She perched herself on the edge of a bench seat, fitted just inside the door, facing the stove, and gratefully took the offered cup of tea. Inside the caravan it was just as Tiffany expected. Miss Tick had everything shipshape without needing a ship. On the walls were lots of little racks, neatly filled with many things, and all annotated in Miss Tick's careful, teachery hand. Tiffany looked closer, and yes, they were in alphabetical order. Elsewhere were little pots without labels, so you would never know what was inside them, and by the side of her bed there was a chart showing a variety of knots. Escapology was a useful hobby for a witch.
"I'll be grateful if you don't touch my little jars," said Miss Tick. "Some of those concoctions might not work properly, and the results are often unpredictable. But, you know, one should keep on experimenting."
"That's what's in all the pots," thought Tiffany, taking a sip of her tea. "Experiments."
"Glad to see you," Miss Tick continued. "I'm hearing about you all the time. You know, almost every girl I meet wants to be you. They see you whizzing about all over the place on your broomstick, and they all want to be you, Mistress Aching. Suddenly, it's becoming a career choice to be a witch."
"Oh, yes," said Tiffany. "That's how it starts out. And then you tell them exactly what they would spend their life doing, and quite a few of them decide to go to the big city and be a hairdresser or something."
"Well, I make no bones about it," said Miss Tick firmly. "I tell them to think hard. It's not all magic and waving wands and all that silly business. It's dirt and grime."
Tiffany sighed. "Being a witch is a man's job. That's why it needs women to do it." Miss Tick laughed and continued, "Well, I remember a little girl who was unsure of herself, and I told her that I would give her lessons that she would never forget in a hurry." Tiffany smiled. "I remember, and now I am in a hurry everywhere these days. But, Miss Tick," she paused and her voice went a bit quiet, "I have a feeling that some of the older witches are beginning to think I might not be able to cope." She swallowed. "Up in Lanka, mostly. But it means I do have to be there a lot." She bit her lip. She hated asking for help. Was she saying that she wasn't really up to the job, letting Granny Weatherwax down, since Granny had been the one to put her name up for it? She couldn't remember Granny ever asking for help. "Down here, on the chalk," she said, "I think I maybe need to, train an apprentice? Have some help?" The heavens didn't open. There was no gasp of horror from the other witch at this request. Miss Tick simply crossed her arms sternly.
"It's Lettice Earwig, I suppose, who's put those doubts into people's heads. She thinks things always have to be done the same way, so that means she would take over, I suppose. She's a senior witch who believes she knows every blessed thing, but it's all just tinkly-winkly stuff. The stupid woman who wrote My Fairy Friends should be ashamed to call herself a witch, and certainly shouldn't hope to walk in the footsteps of Granny Weatherwax. Lettice Earwig certainly couldn't manage two steadings at once. She can't really even cope with one," she snorted derisively. "Do not forget, Tiffany, that I am a teacher,"
said in a way that made everyone listening know this instantly.
"And we teachers can be really nasty when it comes to it. 10 Steps to Witchcraft and The Romance of the Broomstick are not what I would call proper books. Oh, I'll certainly look out for a girl or two for you. It's a very good idea. But you don't need to worry about what Mrs. Earwig might say. Oh, no."
Chapter 7. A Force of Nature. Lettice Earwig was not someone who would take being balked lying down, or standing up, come to that. In truth, she was a force of nature, and she hated to back down on anything. It hadn't taken her long to hear that there had been a queue one day outside Nanny Ogg's home. Tiffany Aching, Mrs. Earwig decided, was not coping, and it needed a witch of senior stature to do something about it. In Lettice Earwig's opinion, never a small thing, she was in fact the only witch who had the stature to act, especially as that old baggage Nanny Ogg wouldn't do a thing. Mrs. Earwig had married an elderly retired wizard many years before. "Wizards ain't allowed to get married," Nanny Ogg had told Tiffany scornfully, "but the silly man got what was coming to him. Talk about henpecked, he was earwig-pecked. She got through all his money, so they says." Tiffany wisely didn't rise to that. It was quite probable that they were actually Nanny Ogg, who hated Mrs. Earwig with an unrelenting determination. But that was why she was relieved when Nanny Ogg wasn't there when Mrs. Earwig arrived at Granny's cottage one morning a week or so later, for what she called one of her little chats. It would have been better, on reflection, if Mrs. Earwig hadn't found Tiffany out in the garden, up to her elbows in suds, in the middle of doing some washing for old Mr. Price. Tiffany's heart sank when she saw the woman coming, and heard her, for Mrs. Earwig's copious amount of jewellery announced the witch with such a cheerful jangle that it was as if it had ambitions to move from being a set of charms and amulets to being a full instrumental fanfare. But she wiped her hands on a towel and welcomed her visitor into the cottage with as much politeness as she could muster. Mrs. Earwig had a tendency to treat Tiffany like a child, and also she had bad manners, such as sitting down without being asked. Mrs. Earwig did, indeed, sit down in Granny's old rocking chair, and she gave Tiffany a smile of blatant insincerity, then made it worse by saying, "My dear girl."
"Woman," said Tiffany quietly, as Mrs. Earwig looked up and down. She was acutely conscious of the suds still clinging to her apron and her dishevelled hair.
"Well, never mind," said Mrs. Earwig, as if it didn't matter. "Now, I thought I should come as a friend and as one of the oldest witches in this area to see how things were going and to offer some constructive advice."
She looked around the kitchen with a superior air, with a particularly sharp glare at the dust that was happily playing little games with itself over the stone flagstones, and Tiffany was suddenly very aware of the spiders which had remained in residence in the scullery, with lots of little ones adding to the colony. She hadn't the heart to move them.
"Don't you think you are overstretched trying to look after two steadings, my dear?" Mrs. Earwig added, with a saccharine smile. "Yes, my dear Mrs. Earwig," Tiffany said back rather sharply. "I am stretched, because there is a lot to do in both places and not much time."
"Which you are taking up," she thought, "but two can play at your game.
If you have some advice," she added, with a smile to match Mrs. Earwig's, "I'll be glad to hear it."
Mrs. Earwig was never one to ignore an invitation. Not that she had needed one, anyway, since she immediately launched into a prepared speech.
"I'm not saying you are a bad person, my dear. It's just that you can't cope, and people are talking about it."
"Perhaps they do," said Tiffany, "and often they thank me. But I am just one woman, that is, woman, not girl, so I can't do everything at once. It's just a shame that there aren't more elder witches around."
Her voice trailed off, the memory of Granny Weatherwax lying in her willow casket still too fresh in her mind.
"I understand," said Mrs. Earwig. "It isn't your fault."
Now her voice was silky smooth, but just a shade beyond patronising and moving towards out-and-out rudeness.
"You have indeed been flung into areas you can't manage, and you are, in fact, far too young, dear Tiffany, to take the right steps on the path of magic. You surely need the counsel of an elder witch," she sniffed, "a serious elder witch with the right approach, no family ties."
And it was clear that she did not consider Nanny Ogg to be a candidate for this task. Tiffany bridled. If there was one thing she hated more than "my dear girl," it was "dear Tiffany," and she well remembered the counsel Mrs. Earwig had given to her protégé, Anagramma Hawkin, who had taken over a witch's cottage, knowing everything possible about runes and tinkly spells, but nothing at all useful. She had needed Tiffany's help. As for implying that Nanny Ogg would not be a good mentor...
"Well, my dear," Mrs. Earwig continued, "as one of the most senior witches in this area, I therefore feel I should take the place of Granny Weatherwax. It's the way it has always been done, and for a good reason. People need a senior witch to be a person whom they can respect, someone they can look up to. After all, my dear girl, a witch of high standing would never be seen doing the washing."
"Really?" said Tiffany, gritting her teeth. A second, "my dear girl."
One more, and she would want not only to thrust Mrs. Earwig into the suds, but also to hold her head under for quite some time. "Granny Weatherwax always said, 'You do the good that is in front of you, and I don't care who sees me doing an old man's washing. There's lots to do, and a lot of it is dirty, Mrs. Earwig.'" Mrs. Earwig flamed at that and said,
"Are we, my dear girl?"
"Not my dear girl," Tiffany snapped. "Mrs. Earwig,"
not a trace of "Are we, your last book was called To Ride a Golden Broomstick.
Can you tell me, Mrs. Earwig, how does it fly? Gold is rather heavy. You might say, in fact, that it is extremely heavy."
Mrs. Earwig growled. Tiffany had never heard her growl before, but this one was a heavy-duty growl.
"It's a metaphor," she said sharply.
"Really," said Tiffany. Now she was angry.
"What's it a metaphor for, Mrs. Earwig? I'm on the sharp end of witchcraft, which means doing what should be done as best you can. It's all about the people, Mrs. Earwig, not about the books. Have you ever gone round the houses, Mrs. Earwig? Helped a kid with his arse halfway out of his trousers? Do you even see the little children with no shoes? The cupboards with no food in them? The wives with a baby every year and a man down the pub?
You have been kind enough to offer some advice.
If I may offer you some advice in return, you'll impress me if you too go round the houses, and not before. I am the acknowledged successor of Granny Weatherwax, who was brought up as a witch by Nanny Gripes, who learned it from witches going all the way back to Black Alice, and that doesn't change whatever you might think. She stood up and opened the front door. Thank you for taking the time to come and see me. Now, as you have pointed out, I have lots to do, in my own way, and clearly you haven't. One thing about Mrs. Earwig, Tiffany thought, was that she could flounce. She flounced so much that it almost hurt. Things jingled a merry farewell around her, and one charm even made a spirited attempt to stay by hooking itself around the doorknob as Mrs. Earwig turned the threshold. The last thing she said to Tiffany, as she untangled the little pendant, was, "A trade. A really trade. I invited you to take advantage of all A know about witchcraft, but no. You flung May Goodwill right back in my face. You know, we could really have been friends if you weren't so stubborn. Farewell, my dear girl." Having got the last word in, Mrs. Earwig slammed the door behind her as she left. Tiffany looked at it and said to herself, "I do what is needful, Mrs. Earwig, not what I want to do." But the banging of the door as punctuation caused Tiffany to think, and she thought suddenly, "I want to do it my way, not how the other witches think it should be done. I can't be Granny Weatherwax for them. I can only be me. Tiffany aching." But she realised something else, too. "Mrs. Earwig was right about at least one thing," she said aloud. "I am trying to do too much. And if Jeannie is right, and there is something awful coming," she shuddered, "which I will have to deal with, but I really hope Miss Tick can find me a girl who might be some use. I do need some help." "Aye, would seem so," said the voice of Rob Anybody. Tiffany almost exploded. "Are you always looking after me, Rob Anybody?" "Ook aye. Remember, there's a geese upon us to look after ye day and nicht, and it's a great geese." A geese. Backed up by tradition and magic, Tiffany knew that a geese was an obligation no feagle would ever fail to meet. Except Daft Woolly, of course, who often mixed up his geese with a flock of big butties. She understood all this, but it still rankled. "You watch me all the time, even when I'm bathing," she said wearily. It was a familiar argument. Tiffany, for no reason Rob could understand, seemed to take exception to the feagles being around her everywhere. They had already come to an agreement about the privy. Though a feagle will cheerfully lie about almost anything, so Tiffany still went into any privy with her eyes peeled for flashes of feagle. She had even once had a nightmare about a feagle popping up out of the other hole of her parents' two-holer.
"Ok, that we do. Not looking, ye ken."
"Well," said Tiffany, "could you do me a favour?"
"Ok," said Rob. "Would you like young Earwig wifey dropped in a pond or something?"
Tiffany sighed. "Alas, no, I'm not that kind of person."
"Ah, but we is," said Rob Anybody cheerfully. "Anyway, it's traditional, ye ken, and we are good at tradition, being as we are part of folklore," he smiled hopefully.
"A very nice thought," said Tiffany, "but no, once again, no. Mrs. Earwig is not really a bad soul." "That is true," she thought. "Stupid, sometimes overbearing, unfeeling, and not really, if you get down to it, a very good witch. But there is a steel there at the core." Tiffany knew Nanny Ogg rarely did any washing. What were daughters-in-law for? But she realised suddenly that she had never seen Granny Weatherwax doing any laundry for the old gentleman either. And that thought stopped her for a moment. "I need time to work this out," she thought, looking at the big man of the Knack-Mack Feagles standing in front of her, ready for anything. This would be a tough task for them, she knew.
"I've a wee geese to lay on you," she said. "Ook aye."
"Rob, have you heard of washing clothes?"
"Ook aye, we ken it happens," said Rob Anybody.
He scratched at his spog, and a mixture of dead insects, half-gnawed chicken foot bones and the like showered out. "Well then," said Tiffany, "I would deem it a favour if you could spend some time in my scullery whilst I am about my business. You would be helping an old man, indeed you would. He likes to be clean and to have clean clothes." She glared down at him. "A circumstance, Rob, which would be well considered by yourself." She approached the scullery door in trepidation when she got back from her visits. Everything was shining clean, and draped among the trees outside were old Mr. Price's unmentionables, as white could be. Only then did Tiffany draw breath.
"Excellent," she said to Rob Anybody.
He smiled and said, "Aye, we ken this would be a tricky job."
"Good job I was with you this time," came a voice. It was wee Mad Arthur, a feagle who didn't mind washing, due to his having been raised by a bunch of cobblers and then being a policeman in the big city. Wee Mad Arthur, Tiffany often thought, had a battle raging inside him between his feagle half and the city half. But since every feagle liked a good punch-up, well, a fight inside yourself was just an extra treat.
Big Yan pushed Wee Mad Arthur aside and said, "We dinna mind helping old Big Jobs getting them squeaky clean, but we are the feagles and we treasure our dirt. Washing makes a feagle wither awa. We canna abide the soap, ye ken."
"Nay me, Rob, nay me," came a happy voice, and Daft Woolly fell off the wall of the old goat paddock. Bubbles floated away on the air as he rolled across the grass.
"I've told you about that, Woolly," Rob snapped. "It just makes bubbles come out of your ears."
Tiffany laughed. "Well, you could make your own soap, Woolly. Make some for Jeannie. Take a wee present home to your kelder. It's easy to make. You just need some fat and some lye."
"Oh, hi, we're good liars, we are," Rob put in proudly. "Famed for it, you ken."
"Well, I tried," thought Tiffany. "And anyway, their spirits are pure, if not particularly clean." Down on the chalk, at the edge of a dark forest, on the top of a hill overlooking Two Shirts, a small town with growing aspirations of being a bit more than one store, a coaching inn and a blacksmith's shop, the Queen of the Elves smiled in satisfaction. It was a warm night, and the air smelled as it always did, and the sky looked as it always did. There appeared to be a new road or stream into the town which glimmered in the moonlight, but otherwise things seemed just as they had been on her last visit. She turned to look at her goblin prisoner, who was perched with his hands bound on the saddle behind one of her guards. She smiled, and it was not a pleasant smile. She would hand him over to Lord Lankin, she thought. The elf would enjoy tearing the wretched goblin limb from limb, after he had had his pleasure playing with his prey, of course. But first, this goblin filth had led them here, to this hillside. The Queen and her raiding party looked down at the sleeping valley ahead. Her warriors wore scraps of fur and leather, feathers tucked into headbands and dangling around their necks, and they carried bows with the arrows already nocked. The gate between the worlds had given them very little trouble in the end. It had not taken much effort for the stronger elves to push through. The barrier was, indeed, very weak just now. Before, the old witch would surely have kept it strong, kept them out, for she had always been on the watch for the fairy folk. Animals noticed them too. At the very moment the Queen stepped onto the chalk, the hares on the downs had turned and frozen, whilst the owls out hunting had soared higher, sensing the unwelcome presence of another predator. Humans, however, were usually the last to notice anything, which made them so much more fun. Apart from a glow above a mound on the hillside and a distant noise of roistering that the Queen recognised as being the usual sounds of the knack-mack feagle, there had been nothing so far to trouble the first elf incursion into the Discworld for many years, and the elves had begun to enjoy themselves. They had caroused through a couple of villages, letting out cows, upturning carts, turning the milk in the churn sour, spoiling a cask of ale, and generally amusing themselves with such trifles. But the growing little town below promised all sorts of entertainment for elves who had been denied the pleasures of a raid for far too long. Apart from the delicate tinkling of myriad bells attached to the harnesses of the raiding party's black horses, there was silence as the elves waited for their queen to give the signal. She raised her arm. But before she could do anything, suddenly, screaming through the air, there came a noise as though someone was killing a gigantic pig. It was a sound which enveloped the whole of the chalk, a screaming whistle which screeched around the hills, setting everyone's teeth on edge. Down in the valley, the air now seemed to be full of fire as a huge iron monster tore along the silvery trail towards the town, clouds of steam marking its path. The elves reeled, panic spreading rapidly from elf to elf as they shrank from the noise, from the sound, from the very scent of iron in the air. Nonchalantly, Of the Lathe the Swarf jumped down from the saddle, used his teeth to steal a stone knife from the guard, whose hands were now covering his pointy ears in an effort to block out the sound, and swiftly sliced through his bonds.
"Told you! Iron horse, that is," he said importantly. "Last train into Two Shirts, is that? That's where goblins work. With steel and iron."
The Queen hadn't flinched. She knew that,
Some of the others had, but she could deal with them later. No elf should show fear in front of his queen. But in her mind she thought, train? It's big. It's iron, and we don't know about it. And what we don't know about it could get us killed.
How can we tame it? She demanded. More importantly, can we make it ours? What grief we could make with something like that!
Peas Blossom, a calm Peas Blossom, seemingly impervious to the general sense of terror among the elves, was at her elbow and smiled, a smile the queen didn't like. It cut through the dramatic style of the face he had chosen to wear, his eyes cold and merciless. He said, "We can torment the goblins until they tell us how to control it. Then they can do it for us."
"They won't," said of the lathe the swarf, giving Peas Blossom a dirty look. "Why should they?"
Peas Blossom reached down to grab the goblin, and of the lathe the swarf reacted quickly, thrusting his small hands into his pockets and throwing a shower of silvery scraps over the elf. Peas Blossom screamed in pain as he fell from his horse. The goblin laughed as the other elves hastily backed away.
"Forgot what's in my pockets, Mr. Pea-Pea Flower. Told you about Swarf, I did. Part of my name. Hurts, does it? Touch clever goblin these days, nasty things happens. Especially to elves."
He pointed down at Peas Blossom, whose glamour had completely deserted him under the onslaught of the shower of iron filings. The elf lay writhing on the grass, a small, weak, pathetic creature crying from the pain.
"Funny, no?" said the goblin. "In this new world, little things like swarf and goblins do matter."